Steinar looked at his monarchs thoughtfully. There were times when he had to remind himself that Merlin Athrawes had his own agenda. Or perhaps it would have been more accurate to say Nimue Alban had her own agenda. Better yet, her own mission. The Archbishop never doubted Merlin's loyalty to Caris and the people who had become his friends, his family. Yet under all of that, sometimes obscured by that loyalty though it might be, lay the granite purpose which had sent Nimue Alban knowingly to her death, so that 9 centuries later, her Pika might walk the soil of a planet she herself would never see. There had to be times, Steinar thought, when Merlin found the imperatives of Nimue's mission clashing with his own loyalties here on Safehold. It could scarcely be any other way, and the Archbishop hoped whatever he had in mind this time didn't fall into that category. Yet if it did, he knew Merlin would meet that challenge as unflinchingly as he'd met every other challenge, and Steinar found himself murmuring a silent, heartfelt prayer for the soul which had accepted such a burden. "Well," he said then, holding out the whiskey glass which had somehow mysteriously become empty, "I suppose I should probably fortify my nerve a little more before I find myself subjected to such a stressful revelation." "Oh, what a marvelous rationale, Michael," Charlian laughed. "Wait a minute while I finish my glass and I'll join you." "Don't get too fortified, either of you," Caleb said sternly, "or not before we're finished with our immediate business, at least." "Immediate business?" Steinar repeated. "Oh, I know what he's talking about," Charlian said. The Archbishop looked at her and she shrugged. "Narman."
"Nar?"
Steinar began, then nodded in sudden understanding.
"You mean whether or not he should be admitted to the inner circle?"
Caleb nodded, and the Archbishop looked at him curiously.
"I'm just a bit surprised you want to discuss it when Merlin isn't here to put in his quartermark's worth."
"Merlin," Caleb said, "has already voted. And, I might add, treated Charlie and me to some fairly pithy comments on the Brethren. Something about decision processes, glaciers, cranky old men, and watched pots."
"Oh, my,"
Steinar said again, in a rather different tone, and shook his head with a chuckle.
"I wondered why he hadn't been pestering Jean about it lately. It hadn't occurred to me that it might be because of something as un-Merlin-like as tact, though."
"I wouldn't go quite that far myself," Caleb said dryly. "I think it may have been more of a matter of not trusting himself to remain civil. He's pretty damned adamant about it, actually. And to be honest, I think part of that's because he's pretty sure Narman has already figured out even more than we've told him."
Steinar's eyes widened with what might have been an edge of alarm, but the Emperor waved his hand in a brushing away gesture.
"Oh, I don't think even Narman could have gotten too close to guessing what's really going on. For that matter, I'm pretty sure that if he had, you'd have been in a better position than anyone else to notice it, given where the two of you have been for the last few months.
But I do think Merlin has a point about his having put together enough to at least be asking himself questions we haven't gotten around to answering for him yet. And as we all know, Narman has a distinct tendency to eventually get answers when he goes looking for them."
"Now that," Steinar thought, "is an outstanding example of understatement."
There might have been 1 or 2 men on Safehold who were smarter than Narman Bates, the Archbishop reflected. He was quite certain, though, that there weren't 3 of them. If he'd ever entertained any doubts on that head, they'd been firmly laid to rest during the long days of the lengthy voyage from Emerald to Chisholm. With Narman's cousin, the Earl of Pine Hollow, to keep an eye on matters of state in Emerald, the rotund little prince had been perfectly willing to return to Chisholm. Mostly, Steinar suspected, because that was where the court was, and Narman simply couldn't stand being away from the great game, even if he had found himself drafted onto someone else's team after his own was eliminated early in the playoffs.
The only thing he'd insisted upon was that his wife, Princess Olivia, join him this time. And watching the two of them together during the voyage, Stainer had understood that perfectly as well. As a matter of fact, Stainer had been very much in favor of Olivia's coming along. He strongly suspected that Narmon's wife, who was one of the shrewdest women the Archbishop had ever met, helped to keep the sometimes potentially too bright for his own good Narmon centered, and that was a very good thing. Of course, it could present a few additional difficulties of its own, under the circumstances.
"As a matter of fact, Caleb, I agree with your assessment of Narmon," he said out loud. "And with Merlin's, for that matter. And unlike Merlin, I have been pressing Jean for a decision, which, I might add, he hasn't given me yet." "No?"
Caleb sat back, gazing at the Archbishop. The short silence seemed considerably longer than it actually was, and then the Emperor grimaced.
"He may not have given you an answer yet, Michael. This time, though, I think he's going to have to."
At that particular moment, Stainer thought, Caleb looked a great deal like his father. There was very little humor in his brown eyes, and, at least as importantly, Charlian's expression was as serious as her husband's.
"I don't want to get up on my Emperor's high dragon with the Brethren any more often than I have to," Caleb continued, "but in this instance, I think I do have to. They've been debating this particular decision for months. They started on it well before you ever left for Emerald, for God's sake, and I can't afford to let it go on any longer. I'm going to have to insist they give me a decision, now."
Stainer looked at both of his monarchs for a long, silent moment, then dipped his head in an unusual formal gesture of respect. But then he looked up again, meeting their eyes steadily.
"If you wish a decision, Your Grace, then you'll have one," he said gravely. "But you have considered the consequences if the Brethren agree and it goes poorly?"
"We have," Charlian said grimly, before Caleb could reply. Stainer turned toward her, and she returned his regard with equal steadiness. "If we tell Narmon the truth, and it turns out we've misjudged his reaction, we both know what we'll have to do, Michael. I pray it won't come to that. And if it does, I'm sure I'll spend the rest of my life regretting it and asking God's forgiveness. But if the decision has to be made, we will make it." She smiled bleakly. "After all, we've faced the same possibility with everyone we've brought inside. So far, we've come up golden every time, as Caleb likes to put it. And to be honest, part of that is probably exactly because the Brethren's first instinct is always to go slow and think things through as thoroughly as possible. But we've always known that, sooner or later, we're almost certain to be mistaken. And we've always known what the price of that mistake will be, just as we've accepted that there are some people we'll never be able to tell the complete truth."
"Very well, Your Majesty. You'll have your answer, one way or the other, this very day."
"That, Harvey, as always, was delicious," Charlian said with simple sincerity, several hours later, as the servants finished clearing the dessert plates. "You spoil us shamelessly, you know, you and all the staff, which is probably why we appreciate you all so much. Thank you. And please pass that on to Mistress Barr and the rest of the kitchen staff as well."
"Of course, Your Majesty,"
Sir Harvey Falgrain agreed with a smile and a deep bow. Falgrain, the palace's major domo, saw to it that its organization ran with the sort of smooth efficiency any military command might have envied, and few could have attained. Given the identities of the Emperor and Empress's dinner guests, he'd taken personal charge of tonight's supper to make certain nothing went wrong, and he was obviously pleased by Charlian's compliments.
"And now," Caleb said, "I think we can take care of ourselves for a while, Harvey. Just leave the bottles on the side table, and we'll ring if we need anything else."
He smiled as he spoke, and Falgrain smiled back. Then the majordomo bowed once again, this time a more general courtesy, directed at all of the diners, and withdrew. Caleb watched him go until the door closed behind him, then returned his attention to his and Charlian's guests. In some ways, many ways, if he were going to be honest, he wished there were only two of those guests, not three. He supposed they could have insisted this would be a working supper to which Princess Olivia was not invited. In fact, they'd started to do exactly that. But then they'd thought about it a bit more and realized just how unwise that might have proved. First, it would have been uncharacteristically rude. He and Charlian would have regretted that, but they could have lived with it. Unfortunately, Olivia Bates was a very, very smart woman. If she'd been excluded from the invitation and something happened to Narmon, she was more than capable of asking exactly the sorts of questions Narmon himself would have asked. It was entirely possible she'd get answers to them, too. And even if she didn't, turning her against Karis would be only marginally less disastrous than turning Narmon into an enemy would have been. Second, though, Narmon and Olivia, in their own ways, were at least as close as Caleb and Charlian themselves. The steadying influence she exercised upon him grew out of that closeness, the strength of that commitment and love. Not telling her after they'd told Narmon would put the portly little prince in a position just as invidious as Caleb's had been before Charlian finally learned the truth. And on top of all that, it was distinctly possible that telling both him and Olivia at the same time would make it easier for both of them to accept the truth. Neither Caleb nor Charlian were entirely happy with the decision they'd finally reached, but in the end, it had been the only one they could reach. "Well, if Merlin's right about both of them, it's not going to be a problem," Caleb told himself yet again. "Of course, Merlin would be the first to admit that he has made a mistake or two along the way. Speaking of which, why don't you come over here and join us, Merlin?" he invited, looking over his shoulder at the tall, blue-eyed guardsman standing just inside the dining room door. Merlin Athrawis smiled slightly as Olivia Bates looked up just that little bit too quickly from her quiet conversation with Charlian. Princess Olivia had spent decades married to a reigning head of state. Along the way, she'd learned to conceal little things like surprise far better than most mere mortals ever did. Normally, at least. Narmon, on the other hand, had had ample opportunity to watch Caleb and Merlin interact during the Coruscant campaign. In fact, he'd already been informed that the Sajan saw visions, that his function as seer and advisor was even more important than his function as Caleb's personal bodyguard. Along the way, he'd also come to understand that Captain Athrawis's relationship with both Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian was even closer than most other people would ever have surmised. That was something he'd learned to factor into his analyses of Merlin's visions. It was not, however, knowledge he had ever shared with his wife, and the fact that the Emperor and Empress had apparently decided it was time for Olivia to discover at least part of what he himself already knew had to have come as a significant surprise for him as well. If so, it wasn't evident. He simply cocked his head with a mildly speculative expression, which would probably have fooled just about anyone. Merlin had come to know the plump little prince at least as well as Narmon had come to know him, however, and he could almost literally see the thoughts flickering through that agile brain. "Of course, Your Grace," he murmured out loud, and crossed to the table. Caleb's wave indicated a chair between himself and Michael Stainer, and Merlin bowed in acknowledgement. He unbuckled his weapons harness, standing his sheathed katana and wakizashi against the wall, then pulled back the indicated chair and seated himself in it.
"Wine, Merlin?" Stainer inquired with a whimsical smile.
"If you please, Your Eminence," Merlin replied, and watched Princess Olivia's bemused expression from the corner of one eye as the primate of the Church of Caris poured wine for a mere bodyguard. The Archbishop passed the glass across, and Merlin nodded in gratitude and took a sip.
"Narmin, Olivia," Caleb said then, gathering back up the prince and princess's attention. "As I'm sure both of you have already deduced, Charlian and I invited Merlin to join us at table to make a point. And that point, as I'm sure both of you have also already realized, is that Merlin is quite a bit more than simply my bodyguard. In fact, Olivia, Narmin was already acquainted with that minor fact, although I'm aware he hasn't shared that knowledge with you."
"Indeed he hasn't, Your Grace," Olivia said, when he paused for a moment, and despite herself, there was an edge of anxiety in her voice.
"We know that," Charlian said quickly, reaching out to touch the older woman's arm reassuringly. Olivia looked at her, and the Empress smiled.
"Trust me, when I say we know, Narmin has never betrayed a single one of our confidences, even to you, we truly do. You'll understand what I mean after Merlin completes his explanation."
"Explanation, Your Majesty?"
Olivia's confusion showed much more clearly this time, and Charlian nodded. Then she glanced at Merlin.
"Why don't you go ahead and begin?" she invited.
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Merlin bent his head in acknowledgement, then looked across the table at Olivia.
"Prince Narmin has already heard a part of this, Your Highness," he said, "but most of it will be equally new to him. Or perhaps I should say, he's about to discover that the information he's already been given was incomplete."
"I apologize for that, Your Highness," he said, shifting his attention to Narmin for a moment, "but it was one of those need-to-know items, as I feel confident you'll understand when I finish explaining."
"Should I assume something has changed and given me the need to know after all, Sage and Merlin? And for some reason, Olivia as well?"
Narmin asked the question calmly, but he also reached out to take his wife's hand reassuringly. There was something profoundly touching about the protectiveness in that small gesture, Merlin thought, and felt his heart warming to the pudgy Emeraldian.
"It's not so much something that's changed as a decision process which has worked its way through, Your Highness," Merlin told him. "There were more people involved in making that decision than even you can have suspected, I think. And most of those other people lacked the unfair advantages, you might say, which you were already aware I myself possess. That tended to make them more hesitant. Well, cautious would actually be a better word, than they might have been otherwise."
"But not you," Narmin murmured with a smile, and Merlin shrugged.
"We wouldn't be having this conversation if Caleb, Charlian, and Archbishop Michael weren't already quite confident about how it will work out, Your Highness. None of us is infallible, so it's possible we're all wrong about that. I don't think that's very likely, though."
"Well, I suppose that's a relief," Narmin said. "On the other hand, perhaps you should go ahead and begin that explanation now."
"Certainly, Your Highness."
Despite the potential gravity of the moment, Merlin found it difficult not to chuckle at the mingled exasperation, impatience, and humor in Narmin's tone. Then the temptation faded, and he leaned forward in his chair, folding his hands around the base of his wine glass as he looked soberly at Narmin and Olivia.
"I realize better than either of you probably even begin to suspect just how disillusioned both of you are with the group of four," he said very levelly. "I know, I don't suspect, I don't think, I don't estimate, I know that Princess Olivia is just as disgusted and heartsick and angry as Caleb or Charlian themselves over the way Clinton and Trinaire are using and abusing the Church's authority and the faith of every Safeholdian. By the same token,
I know your own disgust over the group of four's blatant corruption and taste for tyranny is far deeper than you'd really like anyone else to guess, given that cynical, pragmatic, ruthless politician's image you've spent so long cultivating, Your Highness. He smiled faintly at Narman's slightly affronted expression, yet no trace of his amusement touched his somber tone as he continued. But what neither of you know is that the group of four are scarcely the first to abuse the faith of all Safeholdians for their own purposes. In fact, they're following in a tradition that was established even before the day of creation. The husband and wife, sitting across the table from him, stiffened in unison, their eyes widening in confusion, and this time his smile was far, far grimmer. You see, just over 1,000 years ago. The silence in the dining room was profound when Merlin finished his explanation 2 hours later. The faint, icy sigh of the winter wind, plucking at cornices, battlements, and gables, tapping invisible fingers on the closed window panes, was clearly audible, despite the solidity of the palace's ancient stony bulk. Narman and Olivia Bates sat side by side, holding hands as they had from the moment Merlin began, and Olivia's eyes were huge dark pools in the lamplight. As they clung to the communicator, the compact holographic projector, and the bare wakizashi lying on the table before her. Merlin wondered, looking at her, which of his bits of story-proving technological evidence she'd found most convincing. In some ways, he suspected it had probably been the wakizashi. The communicator and the projector both looked alien, strange, even magical. The wakizashi didn't, yet she'd watched him use the impossibly sharp battle steel blade to whittle long slivers of iron off the poker he'd selected from the dining room fireplace tools. The fact that the wakizashi didn't look alien, yet obviously was, had probably made it even more impressive. "And I'd better make damn sure that poker disappears for good," he reminded himself. Better for the servants to wonder where it went than find it chopped up like a Christmas goose. He felt a brief pang at his own choice of similes and wondered if it was his recitation of humanity's true history which had recalled it to his thoughts. Narman's expression gave away much less than his wife's did. Her wonder and the ghost-haunted eyes that went with it were plain. Narman's eyes were merely hooded, thoughtful. His lips pursed as if he were pondering an everyday conundrum rather than a complete and fundamental shift in the universe he'd always thought existed. "Well," Caleb said quietly, at last, into the silence. Olivia's head snapped up, her eyes flitting to the Emperor like startled rabbits. Narman simply looked at Caleb, but his free hand reached across to join the one already holding his wife's. He patted the back of her hand gently, reassuringly, then looked across the table at Merlin.
"It wasn't Her Majesty's bodyguards who saved her life, after all, was it, Sajan Merlin?" he asked calmly. "Not entirely."
"Not entirely, no, Your Highness." Merlin's voice was low, his sapphire pika eyes dark. "Without them, I would have been too late, though, and it's my fault so many of them died. I dropped the ball badly that day." Charlian stirred in her chair, as if she wanted to dispute his verdict, but she didn't, and Narman smiled faintly.
"I've just been replaying that entire morning in my mind."
His tone was almost whimsical.
"Here I thought you'd explain so much, when it turns out there was so much more you didn't even touch on."
He shook his head.
"I have to admit that a few things make a lot more sense now than they did then, though. For one thing, I've been persistently perplexed by the extent to which their majesties seem to think so much alike. Mind you, I've had enough experience of how well a man and a wife can learn to read one another's minds. And..."
The skin around his eyes crinkled as he smiled briefly but warmly at Olivia.
of the way they can still surprise one another, even after years. But you two,
he transferred his gaze back to Caleb and Charlian,
haven't been together that long, which is why you've amazed me more than once by how smoothly your actions and decisions have coordinated, despite the fact that you were months of travel time apart. The way Her Majesty decided on her own to come home to Chisholm after the assassination attempt, for example. That was exactly what I felt needed to be done. In fact, it was what I advised rather strongly that very morning, but it had never occurred to me that she might actually do it so promptly. Now I understand how the two of you have managed it.
In fairness to Caleb and Charlian, Your Highness, they didn't have the advantage of instant communication until after the assassination attempt, Merlin pointed out, and Narmon nodded thoughtfully.
You're right, he agreed, and they were operating almost that smoothly even before that, weren't they?
Yes, they were, Caleb said rather dryly. Which brings me back to my original question, Your Highness.
I won't say it doesn't come as a considerable surprise, Your Grace, Narmon acknowledged. Of course, I suspect you'd be a bit disappointed if it hadn't. The odd thing, though, is that I don't think it's really shocked me.
It hasn't.
There was a faint but distinct tremor in his wife's voice. He looked at her quickly, and she gave a slightly shaky smile at the concern in his eyes.
I can safely say it shocked me, she continued, and she turned her eyes to Caleb and Charlian. I have to admit it disturbs me as well. Even with all of Sage and Merlin's evidence, you're asking us to believe a great deal, or perhaps I should say to disbelieve a great deal. You're not talking about just the group of four anymore. Not just about corruption in the church, or about evil men twisting God's message. You're telling us the message itself is a lie, that the faith to which we've trusted our souls, the souls of our children, is nothing more than one enormous falsehood.
There's steel in that woman's soul, Merlin thought respectfully. She's telling the truth when she says she's shocked, but she's cutting straight to the core of the entire story, what really matters to her.
That's exactly what Merlin is telling you, in part, Stainer responded before anyone else could.
She looked at the Archbishop, and he smiled sadly at her.
The Church of God Awaiting is a lie, the enormous falsehood you just called it, he said. But the men and women who created that lie built it out of fragments of genuine belief in God. They stole pieces of the truth to build a lie. That's what's made it so damnably, and I choose my adverb with care, Your Highness, believable for so long. But as Merlin said when he began, there really isn't that much difference between Eric Langhorne and the group of four. Aside from the fact that, whether we agree with him or not, Langhorne truly could argue that the very survival of the human race depended upon the success of his lie.
Olivia's eyes narrowed and Stainer shrugged.
I won't dispute a single thing Merlin's had to say about Langhorne and Bedard and the rest of the Archangels. They were mass murderers and clearly megalomaniacs, and what they created was a monster and an abomination before God. I'm a Bedardist myself, and discovering the truth about the patron of my order was one of the more unpleasant experiences of my life. But having said that, the Order of Bedard's done an enormous amount of good over the centuries. I believe it's grown into something quite different from what Adore Bedard had in mind when she was busy reprogramming the minds of helpless sleeping people to make them believe the lie. But I've also been forced to admit I might be wrong about that. We know what she and Langhorne did. We will never know what they were truly thinking when they did it. I'm not proposing that the nobility of their motives, assuming they actually possessed any such thing, justifies their acts. I'm simply saying that we, as human beings, have a tendency to judge on the basis of what we understand, what we see, even when we know intellectually that there are almost certainly things we don't understand and haven't yet seen. We do that with other humans. We do it even with ourselves when you come right down to it. I think we ought to recognize that, Your Highness. And, just perhaps, that we might try to avoid doing the same thing to God.
She gazed at him for several moments, then nodded slowly. It wasn't really a gesture of agreement, not yet at least. But it was a concession of understanding, or perhaps of a beginning of understanding.
In time, Olivia, Charlian said, every human being is going to have to decide how to respond to the lie for himself or herself. I know how I've responded, but no one can predict how everyone else will. That's one reason we've been so cautious when it comes to deciding who we can reveal the truth to.
And if it turns out you were wrong to reveal it to someone, Your Majesty?
Olivia asked very softly.
What happens then?
The fact that you've asked means you already know the answer, Charlian replied, her voice equally soft yet unflinching. We can't and won't pretend about that. God alone knows how many people are going to die before this struggle ends, and the information Merlin shared with you and Narmon tonight would be devastating in the hands of the Temple Loyalists. If you were in our place, what would you be willing to do to prevent it from reaching them?
Silence hovered once more, tense and brittle. Then, surprisingly, Olivia Bates smiled. It was a small smile, but genuine, Merlin realized.
I've been married to Narmon almost as long as you've been alive, Your Majesty, she said. During all those years, he's done his best to shelter me from the harsh realities of the Great Game. I'm afraid, though, that he never really succeeded in that quite as well as he thought he had, even if I didn't have the heart to tell him he hadn't.
She turned her head, her smile growing broader and warmer as her eyes met her husband's, and she squeezed his hand. Then she looked back at Charlian and Caleb, and her expression had sobered once more.
But after all that, of course I know what you would have done, and I don't doubt for a moment that Narmon would have done exactly the same thing in your place. For that matter, she looked Charlian in the eye levelly, so would I. So I suppose it's a good thing for all our sakes that you won't have to.
We won't? Caleb asked quietly, and Olivia shook her head.
Your Grace, if Narmon had been inclined to denounce you as heretics and demon worshippers, he would have done that the moment you told him Sagen Merlin sees visions. You didn't need to tell him the Sagen also flies through the air and doesn't need to do little things like, oh, breathe, for him to have realized there was more at work in him than the group of four guesses. He knew from that moment that Merlin was an unnatural creature, and I don't doubt the writ's warning that such things serve Shan Wei passed through his mind. It's a very active mind, you know.
She smiled again, shaking her head at Narmon, yet managing simultaneously to keep her gaze on Caleb as she continued.
I know my husband, she said simply, and while I don't doubt the Sagen would have been able to keep him under continuous observation, I think he would have succeeded in betraying you if he decided you and Merlin did serve Shan Wei. He might not have survived the experience, but he would have succeeded. And I think, now that you've come to know him, you probably realize he would have done it knowing he wouldn't survive if he truly believed you intended to betray the entire world to the dark.
Narmon's face had turned an interesting shade of pink, Merlin observed, but the rotund little prince didn't flinch.
And she's right about him too, by God, Merlin thought, and shook his head mentally. I wouldn't have thought it myself when I first met him, but she's right. If he'd thought that, he would have done exactly what she's just said.
As it happens, Olivia continued, I have considerable faith in his judgment. It's not infallible, and he's made his share of mistakes, but it's a somewhat smaller share than that of quite a few other princes I could mention. And in this case, I think my judgment agrees with his.
She looked at Stainer.
Your Eminence, I'd really like the opportunity to examine some of those other holy writs you've mentioned. I'm sure that when I do, they'll create plenty of questions of their own. But I was prepared to trust you against the temple when your rejection of Mother Church's interpretation of the only writ I knew of was based on nothing but faith. Perhaps you are asking us to believe even more now, but you're also offering us a lot more in the way of evidence and proof.
She shrugged.
No doubt someone like Clinton will still find all sorts of reasons to reject it. I've already made up my mind that he doesn't worship the same god I do, though, so that's not a problem for me.
Merlin felt himself relaxing as he realized she meant every word of it. He looked around the table and saw his own reaction mirrored, to greater or lesser extent, in each of the other faces. Except Narman's, perhaps. The Prince of Emerald wasn't looking at Merlin Athrawis, nor even at his Emperor and Empress. No, he was looking at someone far more important than either of those august individuals. He was looking at his wife, and for once, as his eyes clung to hers, there was no guard on his expression or his emotions at all. 6. Prince Narman's Sitting Room, Imperial Palace, Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
Good morning, Your Highness. Yes, it is, isn't it? Morning, I mean.
Narman Bates looked out the palace window at a winter-gray Chisholmian day and shuddered. It wasn't actually all that early, Merlin reflected. But then again, Chiraeth was 4 time zones farther east than Erastor. Of course, Narman had enjoyed quite a lengthy voyage, so there'd been plenty of time for his internal clock to reset, which led Merlin to the sad conclusion that Prince Narman simply wasn't what deplorably perky people back on old Earth had persisted in calling a morning person.
Fair enough, Merlin thought, suppressing a temptation to smile. After all, I was never a morning person if I could avoid it either. And what may I do for you at this ungodly frigid hour?
Narman inquired, stepping closer to the fire crackling on the guest sitting chamber's hearth. He held out his hands to the flames, although, to be perfectly fair, it wasn't especially freezing in the sitting chamber, or not by Chisholmian standards at any rate.
Actually, I need to discuss a few things with you, Your Highness,
Merlin said, and Narman's eyes narrowed, his expression turning rather more serious as he looked at the Sajan.
In my role as Their Majesty's Imperial Counselor for Intelligence, he asked, or in my role as new initiate into the Inner Circle?
Both, actually, Merlin shrugged slightly.
I'm sure you've already realized, at least theoretically, how your ability to analyze intelligence is going to shift once we get you properly instructed in the use of your comm. I doubt you're fully prepared for it, though. I mean no offense when I say that, but frankly, I don't see how anyone who hasn't already experienced it could be fully prepared.
Somehow, I don't doubt that at all.
Narman's tone was dry, and he shook his head.
I've been remembering all those neatly written summaries you and Owl have provided, and trying to visualize what it must have been like to actually watch the things you reported in such detail.
He shook his head again.
The one conclusion I've positively come to is that no matter how hard I try to imagine it, the reality's going to be even more impressive, shall we say.
I think that's probably a safe estimate. Still, I also think you'll get accustomed faster than you expect right now.
Merlin smiled. Then his expression sobered a bit.
But another thing you'll discover, unfortunately, is something called information overload.
It was his turn to shake his head.
That's how Charlian almost ended up assassinated, despite all of my snarks and parasites. There was simply too much data coming at me, even with Owl to help, for me to keep track of everything. And unlike you, Your Highness,
I really can go without sleep virtually indefinitely when I need to.
I imagine that's true enough, Narman said thoughtfully. For that matter, I've been thinking about how difficult it must be for their majesties simply to find the time and privacy to sit down and look at all the material you've been describing. It's not as if they can just sit around in the throne room, ignoring everyone else, while they listen to voices no one else can hear, now is it? Sooner or later, people would start to talk.
Believe me, it's even worse than you may have been thinking, Merlin rolled his eyes. I imagine it's going to be at least as bad with you, for that matter.
At least as bad,
Narman repeated, arching both eyebrows.
You've got access to Al's computer files now, Your Highness, and I know where your older children got their taste for reading.
I shudder to think what's going to happen when you find Al's history banks.
And God help us all when you get your hands on a copy of Machiavelli. Machiavelli?
Narman repeated the bizarre-sounding name slowly, wrapping his tongue carefully around the odd syllables.
What a peculiar name.
He cocked his head.
Is that the name of the book or the author?
I'll let you find that out for yourself, Your Highness.
Merlin did shudder delicately. I probably shouldn't have mentioned it to you at all, but I've told Al to help all system users figure out how to do data searches. And knowing you, you'd have turned up all sorts of references to it on your own soon enough.
You realize you're only making me even more curious,
Narman pointed out.
Yes, I guess I am.
Merlin crossed to the window and stood looking out across the winter-dulled countryside beyond.
I think part of it's finally having someone I can talk to about this at all, he said slowly. It's almost as if human history isn't really dead anymore. And I hadn't truly realized how much I missed it until I discovered other people I can actually dare to share it with.
Narman's expression softened, and he laid one hand lightly on the Sajan's shoulder.
There's a proverb, he said quietly. I imagine they had something like it back on old Earth. It says, lonely is the head that wears a crown.
He shook his own head, looking out the window beside Merlin.
I realized years ago just how true that was, but it never occurred to me that there could be someone who was as lonely as you must have been when you woke up in that cave of yours.
Merlin turned his head, looking down at a cross at the pudgy little Emeraldian for a moment, then nodded slowly.
You know, Your Highness, he said in a deliberately lighter tone, I'm happier every day that we managed to settle that unpleasantness between Karis and Emerald without making anyone a foot or so shorter than he used to be.
Especially those of us who had so few inches to spare to begin with.
Narman agreed wryly, looking up at the towering Sajan.
To be sure, Merlin smiled. Then he gave himself a shake.
But I suppose I ought to be getting back to the real reason I came to see you this morning, he said more briskly.
By all means, Narman invited.
The thing is that I'm leaving for Michaelberg as soon as you and I finish this chat. I have an errand there for their majesties, one that actually does have a little something to do with our present conversation. Because I'm going to be away, I won't be able to walk you and Princess Olivia through the familiarization with your comms the way I would otherwise. Caleb and Charlian can do that just fine, though, and I believe they're going to invite you and Archbishop Michael to supper again tonight to do exactly that.
He paused, eyebrows raised, until Narman nodded in understanding, then went on.
Once we've got you up to speed and you're comfortable using the interface with Owl, we'll ask you to help take some of the information load off the rest of us. Caleb and Charlian already have aspects of Owl's total intelligence take that they're responsible for vetting every day. The hard part, where you're concerned, is going to be avoiding the temptation to really load you down. To be honest, Your Highness, I believe you're the best analyst we have. You're certainly better at it than I am, and I think you're actually better at it than Wave Thunder, for that matter. So we need to strike the right balance between having you screening raw data yourself and looking at all the more important things someone else, someone who's not as good an analyst, has turned up for you to consider.
I can see that, Narman mused.
If he was embarrassed by Merlin's compliments about his analytical ability, he hid it well, the Sajan reflected wryly. There are some areas, however, where we are going to want you to take the first look at the data itself, he said out loud. Which brings me to my trip to Michaelberg.
In what way? Narman asked when Merlin paused.
Certain people, the Sajan chose his words with care, are either already talking to people they shouldn't be talking to, or else looking for people they shouldn't be talking to. Some of them are quite highly placed.
I'm not surprised, Narman said sourly. In fact, I could probably hazard a guess at some of the highly placed people in question. Those summaries you used to hand me contained a few of those names, for that matter. Should I assume someone in Michaelberg falls into that category?
There are several people in Michaelberg who fall into that category, as a matter of fact, Your Highness. Merlin grimaced. Fortunately, there are a lot more who might have fallen into it who don't. Duke Eastshire, for example.
Really?
Narman gazed at Merlin intently, then nodded slowly.
Good. Good.
He nodded more firmly.
I thought that was probably the case, but I'm delighted to have it confirmed.
You're not exactly alone in that, Merlin said feelingly, then shrugged. For obvious reasons, we can't go around arresting people when we can't possibly present the evidence, the proof of their treason in an open court. We can use what we know to steer people out of particularly sensitive positions when we know we can't trust them, and we do. But there are a relatively small handful who we know are traitors, who we either can't ease aside without some ironclad justification, or who, for various reasons, we don't want to ease aside.
Knowing who the traitor is allows you to control the information flow, Narman said.
Exactly. Merlin nodded vigorously. That's the thinking behind most of Caleb and Charlian's decisions to leave people in those sorts of positions, and they're going to ask you to take over on monitoring that information flow. Narman nodded again, still gazing thoughtfully up at Merlin. In addition, though, there are a very few people, just a handful, actually, who have been left in place for very specific reasons. Reasons that don't really have much to do with controlling the information they're passing to someone else. Caleb calls them our Master Traineer Specials. He watched Narman's expression expectantly. The prince frowned for a moment, then found himself nodding yet again at the reference to the legendary director of Safeholdian Puppet Theater.
So your journey to Michaelberg has something to do with one of those puppets?
His tone was thoughtfully speculative.
Someone you're maneuvering into doing something himself? Or someone you're using to maneuver someone else into doing something?
Your Highness, watching you in action is one of my guilty pleasures, Merlin told him with a grin. For that matter, it was one of my guilty pleasures even when you were on the other side.
I'm enchanted to discover I've given you so many hours of amusement, Sajan Merlin.
Narman's tone was dry, but his eyes twinkled, and Merlin snorted. Let me tell you about the noble Earl of Swale, he said. He's quite an interesting fellow. He has even more interesting friends, too. And Caleb and Charlian, and I, would appreciate your perspective on him. And for that matter, on exactly how I should go about presenting myself in the course of that errand I mentioned a few minutes ago. You see... 7. Archbishop's Palace, City of Terrace, Province of Glacierheart, Republic of Siddharmark.
Are you certain about this, Your Eminence?
Father Garth Gorja couldn't quite keep his own reservations out of his tone, and Jason Kinnear smiled. Gorja was little more than half Kinnear's own age, and he'd been with the Archbishop literally since leaving seminary. He was adept at all the skills a proper secretary required, and Kinnear had no doubt any number of other bishops or archbishops would cheerfully have hired the younger man away from him. Gorja had never shown the least interest in any of the offers which had come his way, however. Kinnear hoped and believed much of that was because Gorja enjoyed working for him. He certainly treasured the underpriest's services, although he supposed it was selfish of him not to have nudged the boy into taking one of those competing offers. An archbishop with more powerful alliances could probably have moved Gorja's career along more rapidly, after all. By now, he would undoubtedly have been at least an upper priest if he'd been in the service of one of those better-connected prelates. But another aspect of his secretary's loyalty, as Kinnear was well aware, was the fact that he'd been born and raised right here in Glacierheart. His father and older brothers had all gone into the mines in late boyhood, but his parents had decided young Garth would aspire to greater things, and his entire family had shouldered the sacrifices to make it so. The church provided 5 years of schooling to all God's children at no charge. As well she should, Kinnear thought now, sourly, thinking of how many marks the tithe squeezed out of them every year. But it was a rare Glacierheart family who could spare a potential laborer long enough for a child to acquire anything greater than basic literacy. Garth's parents had been determined to do better than that, and somehow they'd managed to keep him out of the mines and in school. Their local priest had seen something in the lad as well, which had earned Garth more attention from his instructors, who, in turn, had discovered that this short, stocky coal miner's son had a first-rate mind. From there, the youngster's path had been pretty much preordained. Mother Church always needed talent, and it had become apparent early on that Garth had a true vocation. That had brought him to the attention of Kinnear's predecessor in Glacierheart, and with his archbishop's sponsorship, he'd attended seminary in Zion itself. The previous archbishop had intended to employ the young seminarian on his staff, and when Kinnear was elevated to his see following his unexpected death, the new archbishop had taken an instant liking to newly ordained Father Garth.
Which probably explains why the young sprout feels qualified to look at me as if I were a slightly addled uncle, that archbishop reflected now. If you mean, am I certain this is a good idea? He said out loud, his tone thoughtful. The answer is yes. If you mean, am I certain this is going to be the most pleasant time of the year for a retreat? The answer is no. If you mean, am I certain the instructions I just gave you were the ones I meant to give you, then again, the answer is yes.
He scratched his chin in obvious rumination for a moment, then gave the younger man a glower. It was fierce, that glower, a thing of majesty and power, slightly flawed by the humor gleaming in his eyes.
Overall, I believe the yeses have it, don't you?
Of course, Your Eminence. Gorja actually blushed a bit, but he also shook his head with true Glacierheart stubbornness. It's just that, as you say, this isn't the best time of the year for a retreat. Especially not to Summit House. I don't even know what shape the house is in, and it's entirely likely we'll get a blizzard through here with little warning. If you're up there with no one but Freidman to look after you and the weather turns really bad... He let his voice trickle off, and Kinnear smiled.
I appreciate your concern, Garth, really I do. But I'm fairly confident even a pair of old dodderers like Freidman and me can survive a few days of isolation. And Summit House has been perched on that peak for over 100 years, so I doubt any storm is likely to knock it down around our ears. And finally, if conditions are going to be a little austere, that's scarcely a minus for a spiritual retreat, now is it?
No, Your Eminence, of course not. It's just that you don't want me out of your sight where I might get myself into trouble?
Kinnear finished dryly, one eyebrow cocked.
Gorgia blushed again, then laughed.
Guilty, Your Eminence, guilty, he confessed with a smile.
But then his expression sobered, and his eyes looked searchingly into his superior's. Kinnear returned that look levelly, steadily, but without answering the questions it asked. He couldn't, wouldn't give Gorgia those answers, not now. He'd decided long ago that the less young Garth knew about his archbishop's riskier activities, the better. It hadn't been easy, keeping the underpriest outside so much of his life, but he'd been active in the circle long before Gorgia entered his service. His conduits to the Wilsons and the circle had already been in place, and he'd simply declined to make his new secretary aware of them. There'd been times he'd questioned that decision, and not just because of how it made his own life more difficult than it might have been. He'd recognized the kindred spirit inside Garth Gorgia, and he'd had little concern, not no concern, no man could ever be absolutely certain of anything before the test, that the young man would have betrayed him or the circle. For that matter, he'd been confident his secretary would have promptly agreed to join the circle's activities. But he'd declined to allow the youngster to make that decision at such an early stage in his own life. It wasn't the sort of thing a man could simply decide to walk away from if he later decided he'd made a mistake, and he'd been more than half afraid Gorgia would have agreed, at least in large part, simply because of his respect and liking for Kinnear himself. By the time a few years had passed, and he'd been more confident Gorgia would have made an informed decision for the right reasons, there'd been other factors. Clinton had become Grand Inquisitor, which had raised the stakes starkly. The circle itself had decided it would henceforth restrict all knowledge of its activities and its very existence to the ranks of the episcopate. Only a limited number of junior clergy already knew about those things, and the circle had judged it best to keep it that way, both for security and to protect their juniors. And finally, Gorgia had married his childhood sweetheart, and the first of their currently three children had already been on the way. Given all of that, Kinnear had decided it was his duty to keep Gorgia away from that part of his life. In fact, for the last 5 years, Gorgia hadn't even accompanied him back to the temple between pastoral visits. Kinnear had engaged another secretary, one he was confident was an Inquisition informant, in fact, in Zion, while he delegated more and more of the routine duties here in Glacierheart to Gorgia. When Bishop Executor Willis Hamilton's secretary, who'd been much more elderly, died of pneumonia 3 years before, Gorgia had slipped into the secretary's role for Hamilton as well, so it had never been as if there weren't plenty of legitimate duties to keep him fully occupied here in Terrace. There'd been times, especially over the past few months, when Kinnear had felt profoundly guilty over not telling Gorgia about the circle. He was far from certain Clinton would believe Gorgia had known nothing about his superior's activities. Worse, he suspected Clinton wouldn't care whether or not Gorgia had been actively involved. The Grand Inquisitor might well decide that, guilty or not, Gorgia would make another excellent pointed example, and it wasn't as if there weren't plenty of underpriests to replace him after all. Yet, in the end, the Archbishop had held fast to his resolve against entangling the younger priest in his own fate. His Zion secretary saw every bit of his correspondence with Gorgia, which was one reason Kinnear had kept him on, even after he'd become confident the man was making regular reports to the Inquisition. That correspondence had never so much as hinted at anything concerning the circle or its activities, and his only real hope was that its routine nature,
coupled with Gorja's genuine ignorance of his superior's disloyal activities, would be his secretary's best defense.
Poor as it may prove in the end, Garth, the Archbishop thought, it's the best I can do for you.
He smiled a bit sadly.
I can't even invite you to run with me, assuming I ever actually get the chance to run.
A desperate flight through the teeth of a mountain winter, with three small children and a pregnant wife, is the last thing you need.
Very well, Your Eminence, Gorja said finally.
I won't say I think you're being foolish, since I'm far too dutiful to ever harbor such disrespectful motions. And perish the thought that a pair of esteemed gentlemen, neither of whom will ever see 60 again, aren't perfectly capable of looking after themselves under even the most primitive of conditions. He gave Kinnear a stern look, then sighed and shook his head when the Archbishop returned it blandly.
I'll make the arrangements, and if you'll give me a 5-day, I'll see to it the coal bins are full and the pantries properly stocked as well.
Thank you, Garth. Kinnear patted the younger man gently on the shoulder.
That's very thoughtful of you. I appreciate it.
Which was true, he thought, and even better, the delay the secretary had asked for would be almost exactly the right length.
8. The Duke of Eastshire's headquarters, Michaelburg, Duchy of Eastshire, Kingdom of Chisholm. If he'd still been a flesh-and-blood human being, Merlin Athrawis reflected, as his most recent remount trotted briskly along under him, he'd really be getting tired of this particular exercise. Or of making this particular trip, at any rate. The city of Michaelburg had been built by Charlian's father, King Salus. It lay just under 150 miles north of Cerraeth, on the narrow neck of land between Lake Morgan and Cherry Bay, and it had been intended from the outset as a fortress city. The three true keys to King Salus's success in breaking the power of the nobles who had marginalized his father and grandfather had been, first, the royal army, which had been commanded by his brother-in-law, the Duke of Halbrook Hollow; second, the Crown's alliance with the Commons, which had been arranged and orchestrated by his boyhood friend, Marak Sandiers, Baron Green Mountain; and third, geography. Well, geography coupled with more of Green Mountain's astute diplomacy. Green Mountain had been very careful to enlist the support of the Duke of Lakeshore, the Duke of Broken Rock, and the Earl of Helena, although he'd had to do rather more dragon trading than he'd really liked, especially in Broken Rock's case. Coupled with the fervent support of the Free City of Port Charles, which had been renamed Port Royal by its citizens as a token of its enthusiasm for the crown, their backing had given Salus, who was himself the Duke of Cerraeth, a solid territorial base of his own. Protected by Lake Morgan and Lake Megan to the west, and by the sea to the east and south, he had commanded the kingdom's best ports and most productive artisans, which had constituted a major advantage over his fractious, internally bickering opposition. Michaelburg had been built on the territory of the then Duke of Eastshire, who had not been one of Salus's greater admirers, to protect that advantage. It had been designed to keep Eastshire on his own side of Lake Morgan, thus freeing Salus to concentrate on the more dangerous, broader approaches across the duchies of Lakeshore and Windshore. And the king had been careful to extend his control gradually, working westward, without ever uncovering his back. The old Duke of Eastshire had been considerate enough to get himself killed in battle before producing an heir of his own body. At that point, the title had passed to a collateral line, and the new duke, the current duke's father, recognizing which way the wind was setting, had become one of the crown's loyal adherents. Despite that, Salus had kept the walls of Michaelburg in excellent repair, and Charlian had followed suit. Of course, Charlene had also completed her father's plans for Lake Morgan and Lake Megan, linking Lake Morgan to Cherry Bay by way of the King Salis Canal and Lake Megan to Lake Morgan via the Edmund Canal. The canals had stimulated the economy of the area around Cherraith still further, and it was no coincidence that the King Salis Canal had been placed in a perfect location for Michaelberg to protect. Michaelberg's proximity to Cherry Bay and to Lake Morgan gave it excellent waterborne communications, which had made it a logical place for the present Duke of Eastshire to go about organizing the new imperial army. It was also connected to Cherraith by a carefully maintained high road, and, as a member of Emperor Caleb's personal guard, Captain Athrawas had priority for fresh horses from the posting stations the Crown maintained along the way. All of which meant he could make the journey between the two cities by horseback in about two of Safehold's long days. If he pushed the pace a bit, he could have made the same trip in a day and a half, or even a little less.
"Of course, if I were able to use the skimmer, I could make it in about 10 minutes, couldn't I?"
he reflected dryly, as he, finally, saw the walls of Michaelberg rising before him. He grimaced only half-humorously at the thought.
"At least it's not as if the time is wasted," he reminded himself.
Nemu Albin had been an indifferent equestrienne at best. She'd learned to ride, more or less, as a little girl, only because her wealthy father, himself a world-class polo player, had insisted. Her own interests had lain elsewhere, a point which had obviously perplexed her father, who had been firmly convinced that every girl child ever born idolized horses. Maybe every other girl child ever born had, but Nemu had been much more interested in sailboats. As a consequence, however, Merlin Athrawas's riding skills had been less than stellar as well. Fortunately, the preferred style on Safehold was what had been called Western style, in remarkably disapproving tones, by young Nemu's riding instructors. Also fortunately, Merlin had a pika's reactions, strength, and ability to literally program his artificial body with muscle memory skills. With those advantages, his performance on horseback had improved dramatically, which had been fortunate for his Sajin's reputation. By now, Merlin was capable of setting himself on autopilot, once he climbed into the saddle and performing there with a polished skill few breathing humans could have bettered. In fact, with the situational awareness provided by his artificially enhanced senses, and the reaction speed provided by his fiber-optic nervous system, he could readily afford to multitask during the lengthy rides between Cherraith and Michaelberg, which gave him the opportunity to catch up on some of the unending data dumps coming to him from Owl's remotes. That was precisely what he'd been doing ever since he'd left the palace, and as usually happened when he had uninterrupted opportunities to examine the data, he'd discovered a few previously unsuspected alligators crawling out of the swamp. Most of those alligators had not yet reached the potentially disastrous stage, but at least one of them was likely to lead to an interesting conversation with Archbishop Michael.
"Under the circumstances, I think I'd better postpone that until I can get home and have it in person, though."
That reflection carried Merlin and his present mount to Michael's Bridge, the largest of the three drawbridges across the King Salis Canal. Iron-shod hooves sounded with a dull hollowness on the bridge's timbers, and Merlin shifted mental gears as he shook himself fully back into the moment. Conversations with Stainer could wait until he got back to Cherraith. The one he was here to have with Duke Eastshire was likely to prove quite interesting enough to be going on with.
Sajin Merlin.
Russell Therys, the Duke of Eastshire, was 45 years old, brown-haired and brown-eyed, a couple of inches under 6 feet tall, and stocky for his height. Although he was one of the Kingdom of Chisholm's highest-born noblemen, he came to his feet as Merlin was ushered into his office. "Your Grace," Merlin replied and bowed deeply.
"It's good to see you again,"
Eastchair continued, extending his hand. They clasped forearms, and the Duke smiled a bit crookedly.
"It's good to see you," he repeated, "but I can't help wondering exactly why I'm seeing you, or rather, seeing you again this soon."
"Actually, Your Grace, there are several reasons, but one of them is more important than any of the others."
Merlin's answering smile was rather more crooked than his host's had been.
"In particular, their majesties have a message for you, which they thought should probably be delivered in person."
"Ah?"
Eastshire raised one eyebrow.
"And to be honest, Your Grace, it's also a bit complicated. I think it's going to take me a little time to explain things properly."
"I see."
Eastshire regarded his visitor thoughtfully. Despite his own loyalty to the crown, and specifically to Charlian Tate Armagh, the Duke was every inch a Chisholmian noble. Since the Duke of Holbrook Hollow's treason, Merlin had satisfied himself, both from personal contact and from the recordings of Al's snarks, that Eastshire's allegiance to the Empire, and despite a few initial reservations, to the Church of Carus as well, was genuine. Despite that, Eastshire was one of those people who had trouble truly grasping the concept that the majority of commoners were just as much people as he was. It wasn't even arrogance in his case, it was simply incomprehension. The natural and innate superiority of the nobly born was so much a part of the world in which he had been raised that it was literally impossible for him to make that leap on anything except a purely intellectual basis. Yet there was one area in which that was clearly not the case, for he had no difficulty at all accepting commoners who also happened to be army officers as the equals of their more aristocratic fellows. In fact, he was well known for ruthlessly quashing any efforts to establish old boy networks of aristocratic patronage when it came to promotions and assignments. Some of that, Merlin suspected, was because Eastshire regarded all his officers, including the common-born ones, as members of his own extended family. Another part, however, was probably institutional, given the fact that the army had been specifically created to break the aristocracy's grip on Chisholm. It had been created around commoners, not aristocrats. And despite the towering nobility of his own birth, Eastshire had no problem maintaining that tradition. In the army, at least, outside the army, he seemed perfectly comfortable with the patronage-backed ascendancy of his fellow aristocrats. In Merlin's case, Eastshire had obviously decided he fell under the soldier heading, even if he had had the bad taste to be born somewhere besides Chisholm, and related to him accordingly. And although Merlin's official rank was still only captain, Eastshire, who was no dummy, clearly realized some captains were more equal than others. In particular, a captain of the Imperial Guard, assigned to head the Emperor's personal detail, who'd first introduced himself to the Emperor by foiling an assassination attempt when the Emperor in question had been a mere crown prince, and who was routinely used by both the Emperor and the Empress as their personal messenger and troubleshooter, was one hell of a lot more equal than other captains. That, Merlin had decided some time ago, was the reason Eastshire habitually addressed him as Sajan rather than using his official rank. And it was probably also the reason he treated a commoner, and a foreign-born commoner at that, as something very close to an equal. Not quite, of course, but close.
"If their majesties think I need to hear something from you personally, why don't you join me for supper?" the Duke asked now. "Lady Eastshire is off visiting our newest grandchild, and she won't be back until sometime late tomorrow, so I was planning on dining at headquarters anyway, then turning in my quarters here instead of riding all the way home. I'd intended to ask some of my staff to join me. Should I assume the nature of your message would make it more advisable for you and me to dine privately?
Actually, Your Grace, Merlin murmured, I think that might be a very good idea.